Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. And today, November 1st, I can hardly believe it, Monday, November 1st, we will welcome Tara Hunt, speaker, author, and one of the most influential women in technology. Tara, are you with us?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you sound great. How are you?
Excellent. Good, good.
So
I'm
glad to have you on the program.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You're absolutely welcome. So now, a lot of people know you from your book, The Woofy Factor, and then your follow-on book. But really, I mean, at least in San Francisco circles, you were sort of a legend before that with citizen agency and citizen space, which if people don't know, maybe I'll give you a chance to kind of describe how you came up in the San Francisco area, because you're originally Canadian and you've gone back to your Canadian roots.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't necessarily say that I was a legend, but we definitely did do some really cool stuff in the area, which for me is a... how I describe myself is, a naive girl from a small town in Alberta, pretty much, born in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. It was a pretty exciting time for me to be going to San Francisco in 2005 when the term Web 2.0, I think, was just being coined, or first Web 2.0 conference, anyways, by O'Reilly Media. And I met... somebody who would become both my romantic partner as well as my business partner pretty shortly after arrival. And within a year of meeting one another, we came up with the concept of citizen agency, which really focused on something that was emerging at the time and is now, I think, pretty common. This idea of community marketing, and it was very focused on, you know, helping build word of mouth through online networks. I think people call it social media now. it's being widely referred to, but at the time it was pretty crazy and new. I mean, Facebook was still closed pretty much to bunch of colleges. Twitter came out about the same time we started Citizen Agency, so there were like, I don't know, there were like 100 of us on there. Ev Williams was our Tamagotchi. It hadn't really exploded the way that it has. I think the big hubbub at the time was about MySpace, but I was hardly using MySpace at all. Most of my activity was in like Flickr and on a blog. I don't know if you remember those things.
I love the way you explain the name of your blog. So people may, I don't know how many people are big, you know, I think blogs are due for a comeback. A friend of mine, Murray Newlands, is creating a San Francisco blogging group that you may not know about. Club, and he had a very successful one in London. I always say, when you do free drinks and you promise them at every event, you're going to get some good people. So Tom Foremski and others have been attending, and it's pretty cool. But you have this great blog called Horse, Pig, Cow. Now, I refer to my mom all the time on the show, so people are probably used to it, and you, at least from what I read, you describe yours in a similar vein, so I'll let you describe how you came up with the name.
Sure. So, my mom used to have this, you know, she'd forget somebody's name. She would be Jill, Horse, Pig, Cow, Jennifer, you know, like she would.
Yeah, I know.
That would be how she would jar her memory. And I don't know where she got it from. Actually, I've asked her on several occasions, and she can't remember how she started saying that, but it just, that's what would come out. And it seemed actually kind of sane and normal when I was growing up, because I was so used to it. And it was my son, actually, who pointed it out to me. He was like, that is really weird. And where did, you know, and I at the time I was starting my blog, and so I bought the URL and named my blog that. It had a whole bunch of significances all of a sudden, you know, reminding me of my roots. I was raised on a farm, and also, yeah, like those, just bringing me back down to what matters, right? Is, you know, friends and family and that sort of thing. So,
yeah, in my family, there's two girls, so it resonates really well with me because my brother and my mother either call us Jennifer, because that's Michelle and Jennifer combined, or Jit Michelle. So, I mean, I don't know how you would buy a blog URL based on that, but it definitely makes complete sense in the regular world. If people don't quite have my name or they remember my handle is on Twitter as opposed to my name, it's kind of funny because it just, you know, it's like, oh, it's no big deal. But it's funny that you mentioned Twitter and the, you know, kind of coming up around the same time Citizen Agency did, because I was actually doing a little research this weekend for something else, and I was looking around at when people started their Twitter pages or their Twitter streams, bought, you know, got their, hopefully didn't buy, but you know, started their name, and it seems like 2009 is the year, but, you know, it had exploded for a lot of people really before that. So I think you're an interesting person to ask, because I feel like every time I work with whether it's an individual or a large company, they feel very pressured, you know, and more that they need to be certain places, and of course Twitter's on the list. What would you say to that? Because you had, you know, you, of course, were there early, and it's changed quite a lot. In fact, it's one of the things I always will, you know, mention to clients when we talk about sort of demographics and that sort of thing, is every single intern I've worked with, I've had to ask them to create a Twitter account so we could collaborate on Hootsuite to be able to get messages out on time and infuse them with the youthful enthusiasm of the next generation, but they're not really comfortable there. I mean, they text, but and you have a son as well who's you know, I know you from, you know, following you on Facebook, is kind of off doing his own thing, and you're really proud of him. So, what's your sort of take on the kind of the changes over the years of where Twitter's gone within the context of business and people?
Whether it's Twitter or anything in this world, it still baffles me. It's still, my ears still prick up when on the treadmill or something at the mall, somebody, or you can follow us on Twitter at blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, it still freaks me out because so many years I was such an edge case, you know, like, I've been participating in online communities. Oh, yeah, I mean, that was my first foray into online was through Usenet groups, right? IRC. I've been participating in this stuff since, like, 1992, like when I was on a 14.4 baud modem, you know? Like, it was so for me to actually, like, have this go mainstream, it's still... still hasn't quite sunk in. I was on Twitter. I think my first tweet was in July of 2006, but I think I joined in June of 2006. I had applied to be on the beta, I think, in May.
Mm-hmm.
Twitter, it didn't have vowels. It had this horrible green goopy looking logo, and everybody thought I was crazy when I started talking about it. Like, I was speaking at conferences, I'd be like, this is the next big thing, and people were like, you're nuts, who cares about, like, what you're doing right now, right? So for me to have this be such a mainstream thing is still, like, it's awesome and mind-blowing. I don't know, like, if I'm taking a look at people feeling anxiety over getting on this stuff. Like, I'm still feeling anxiety that people are getting on this stuff. I get it.
Yeah.
It's a real mind shift. We were like nerdy edge case people. We did hide out in our basements online, you know? And now we're like chic, and that's weird for me. It's really weird, and that everybody is doing it. Like, it doesn't. It just. I hope, you know, I hope in the future that it's, you know, it's. I mean, when I think about it, like, people call themselves like social media gurus and stuff, right? And I think, I hope in the future it would be like calling yourself a telephone guru or like a.
You said that on Facebook last week, and I thought that was really clever because there's this social media group, the new group forum thing that they have on Facebook now. So yeah. I was sort of grandfathered into it somehow, and I don't know if it was there or because I remember Chris Hewer kind of freaked out when he was, same thing as me, you know, just found out that I was part of this group all of a sudden and didn't quite know why. But you've had some really topical observations on Facebook recently, which makes me wonder if you feel like maybe you're getting more value out of Facebook these days in terms of the tools of the trade than maybe some of the other places that you maybe would have presented some of your concepts or ideas, because you have some great ones before.
I think that Facebook is interesting. I mean, you love to hate it, right? You hate to love it. The interface is like awful, and you can. Button, so that's cool, but where do you export it to? Like what, right? So Facebook is interesting, though, because it does, like, everybody's there, and you can create conversation topics. And on Twitter, it becomes noise when you have a big conversation, right? Twitter is, unfortunately, because Twitter started out as the ultimate conversation tool, right? And then so many things change, and people get all uppity about people tweeting too much. I'm sad in the direction that, you know, Twitter has gone as far as human communication. It's turned into this, like, six tweets a day maximum, otherwise people stop following you. Who cares? It's Twitter. It's another expression platform, right? On Facebook, you can be really noisy because it's just your friends, and the way that the filters work on there allow that to happen, and we'll push up a conversation that's popular. And so it does have a lot of good tools for creating better dialogue between people. I find it's fascinating. Like, I can post the same question in three places, like on Twitter, on Facebook, and on Quora, for instance, right? And the big conversation, the big debate that happens on Facebook, the really hipster types, smarty pants, will come out on Quora, and on Twitter it sort of disappears.
Interesting. So, I mean, you know, we touched on, you know, citizen agency, and, you know, when you came to San Francisco, it kind of all happened quickly. You also have Citizen Space, which is a work. It's a shared work environment, which is very cool. And working with Social Media Club, you know, we've held some events there, and it's always a great space because everybody, even if they're there working late, they're like, "Oh, we'll help move chairs or, you know, do whatever." It's a really nice environment that way. And it seemed like a really clever idea at the time because I think, you know, probably now is, I would think, would be like a waiting list to be able to get into the space. But who knows? I mean, it's you've had a really cool journey, though. And I just, after Citizen Agency, you know, talk us through what happened until, you know, I mean, at least from Citizen Agency until getting a book deal. Because, I mean, your book was, you know, published by a pretty big author and, you know, it definitely made a big splash. And I think for me, it gave me the first chance to actually hear you talk. And it was at a social media club event where someone was very excitable and talking over you. And it kind of annoyed me to the point where I think I berated the other person accidentally just because I was so frustrated. It's like, you know, let everyone talk. You know, there's not one platform, because I think the idea of, you know, what our, you know, what our kind of personal currency is matters a lot. So, you know, I think if you take us through the journey and then if you want to talk a little bit about the book, that would be awesome.
Yeah, well, I want to address Citizen Space a little bit, as well as acknowledge that I do believe it was Christy Ure and Christy Wells that came up with the term social media in the first place, and why the whole movement is called social media now, and with the Social Media Club. Chris at least had a desk at Citizen Space for quite a while. Yeah, so, and we're really proud to have, you know, the Social Media Club have events there. It's really cool, and I'm really, really glad. I'm really, like, happy for them and how much that movement has grown. That's great. But Citizen Space, we were sort of working on this in conjunction with, I mean, we didn't even think about Citizen Agency before. Citizen Space was sort of ruminating in our brains. And it was around a movement that is now, or was and is now, called co-working. And it was started as a space called co-working in the Mission by Brad Newberg, who I think he's at Google now. And I think he had it 2 or 3 days a week in a place in the Mission. And he was just getting really busy. And Chris Messina, who was my partner, saw this and just thought, like, what a great idea, and how necessary is it that we need, like, these spaces for independence to come together? So he organized the first meetup, which, you know, I went to sort of take notes, and there were a group of us there, and just sort of, like, fell in love with the idea of growing it into something bigger, like, first of all, like, a space that was full-time, you know, all week long, that people could drop into and drop in like a coffee shop for free, but also rent desks to help offset the cost, that sort of thing. And so we started talking about that, and then it came clear as we were posting a lot of our conversations, videos, as we were looking for a place, blog posts, that lots of people around the world were really interested in doing the same thing. So I think the first space we opened is still in existence. It's called the Hat Factory. And it was like a sublet or a space within a space, similar to the Mission space had been. And it was great, and it kept going. But we wanted to create something sort of more, it was all co-working community, and it wasn't a live-work space. So that's when we opened Citizen Space. And as we opened Citizen Space, we opened up the Google group, and people flooded in from around the world saying, we want to do the same here, or have been working on the same here. Now that, oh gosh, I mean, I could check the numbers, but I would just estimate there's probably well over 4,000 people on that list, hundreds of spaces around the world, and we all exchange our ideas and our ups and downs, and spaces open, they close, and all this different stuff, you know, together, our lessons around that. And it's just this amazing movement of people that just attract people that are really dedicated to community, and not just online, but offline community, local community, and how the mix of that, the blend of that. So, Citizen Space came out of that. So we try to keep it. It's still like this. Nobody makes a profit off Citizen Space. In fact, I sunk a whole bunch of personal money into it when we expanded a couple of years ago, which I never, you know, it's not about me getting that money back ever. but I'm just happy that people get to still enjoy it. So, and I'm still a co-owner, but I'm not very involved in any of the day-to-day operations. But, you know, things like that, like Citizen Space, like Citizen Agency, like the bar camp, the wine camp, which we did, the massive camp, those sort of things that we did over the years that were sort of giving back to the community, those really went towards increasing social currency. And that's what basically I believe led to my book deal. I didn't go after it. It wasn't that I was like, geez, I want to write a book now. It was that people followed me because they liked me as a human being as well as they liked with what I had to say. And then they would tell other people. And, I mean, there was none of it was a campaign. It was all came from a really genuine place. And one day out of the blue, I think it was early 2007, I get an email from a woman named Daniel Svetkov, who turned out to be my literary agent from Levine Greenberg. Really wonderful woman. She's like, I've been hearing your name everywhere. I've been reading your blog. I see you have a good following of people. You have an original thought. We could sell a book for you. And I was like, holy crap. No way. Like, really? That's awesome. Who doesn't want to write a book? But I was like, well, I don't know what, I'm all over the map. You know, what do I write this book on? So she really helped me come up with a really great outline based on all of the stuff that I had been talking about for a while. And yeah, like she sent it around to a bunch of publishers and God, Random House, you know, Crown is part of Random House. Random House, yep. Like the biggest bloody book publisher I know about.
Yep.
Picked it up and I'm like, wow, holy crap again. How does that happen? Like, how lucky am I? And they offer me a lot of money to write this book without, I mean, first time author. And it was crazy to me. I mean, I raised more money on that book than I have on my startup today. So, like, wow.
It happened.
So, yeah. Yeah, which is, you know, and it bowled me over. Like, I still to this day, I'm like scratching my head thinking, how the hell did that happen? But if I really look at all the things that we worked on going in, you know, up to that, you know, the amount that, you know, the times that we were working all hours a night, giving our time, giving our money, giving our love to various different community projects. Like, if you calculated the social capital, I guess, that goes into that, the woofy that goes into that, then it makes sense, right? And, you know, to this day, I really think it's woofy that got me to that place.
So let's talk about woofy. So for people that have been lying under a rock or are new to the space, let's let them in on what woofy is. So the woofy factor was the book that came out of your publisher shopping the deal. And
yeah.
Getting you a deal with a big publisher. So it was really exciting. I remember when the book came out for sort of just the people like Christine, Chris, and other people that I would consider friends that I work with in the space and don't see enough of. And, you know, you're really genuinely happy for someone because they actually have original thoughts that are worth spreading the news about. And that was kind of the word on the street. And then there was a social media club event where I, you know, became aware of it. But for other people who haven't had a chance to read the book, and like I said, they must have been lying under a rock, but explain on just a little bit about what the book, because you talked about lots of different ideas coming from all this community work that you've done, all the blood, sweat, and tears going into various projects. And you know, coming down to distilling to one concept and then what that concept really is.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was coming up with a topic, right, distilling down. There was this really interesting moment of epiphany while I was actually explaining the importance or the potential more than the importance, the potential of this, of online communities to a woman who sells dahlias, grows and sells dahlias. A friend of mine had brought her in, Christopher, oh gosh, I remember forgetting Christopher's last name. Sorry, Christopher. He had brought her into Citizen Space, actually, and said, I wanted you to come meet Tara because I've been trying to explain this stuff to you, but she's really good at explaining it. And so I sat down, and as I started to describe it to her, like a light bulb went off for me. And basically, I said, the rest of the world works in a currency, you know, that we know as money, you know, coins and bills and money. But mm-hmm. on online communities, we work in a currency we known as social capital. And it just kind of came out of my mouth. And after she walked out of the office and actually went on and did quite well with online community stuff, I sat down and I wrote out my book proposal. It was all about social capital. It was all about, like, if I could tie every idea I had around how we were supposed to interact to be successful in online communities back to this idea that no matter what you're doing, you're raising social capital. And all of a sudden things like, the concepts in my book, like embrace the chaos and find your higher purpose and all these things that I've been blah, blah, blahing about for a while just came together under this umbrella of raising social capital. And at the same time, I had ordered Cory Doctorow's book, Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom. And I was taking a trip to Rotterdam to speak at a conference, to keynote a conference. And so I thought, I'll read this book on the plane. And in it, the main currency was Woofy, which basically, like, social capital. So, mm-hmm. yeah, everything just sort of came together at that point. And, it just became this huge light bulb moment where everything that we do in online communities all tie back to this currency.
And so you had a follow-on book to The Woofy Factor that was more about sort of implementing what it means or kind of what you do, in a sense, with the capital that you have.
Well, actually, I hate to say this. I should have said it before. But that book's the same book. It's just been renamed by my publisher. Yes, it's the same
book. Well, that's good for
book.
People to know because
I looked at it
online. Yeah, it sounds like a different kind of book because the book that you have actually goes into a lot of detail about building, you know, social capital / Woofy and then, what it actually means to implement it. So there are examples in the book that explain exactly what you can do. Now, what I thought was kind of interesting was, and maybe this was just in the nerdy circles, around social media that I run in, but there were, like, a lot of people at the time, and I think, there's always a fair amount that are kind of jealous that who gets a book deal, who doesn't, whatever, but about whether Woofy was really the right word for social capital. But I think, did that bother you at all? Because there's always a detractor, somewhere that's got to say something,
right.
Blah, blah, blah. But that's part of the Woofy thing, right, is rising above that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know. Part of being online, is it a fortunate or unfortunate thing, is that you just need to grow thick skin. The word Woofy, I totally understand. And in fact, when my publisher, so my original proposal was for the book to be called How to Be a Social Capitalist. And my publisher actually about a couple months into me writing it, and I had finished like 3 or 4 chapters based on talking about this in the terms of social capital, Woofy was like one little section where I described Corey's book and just, you know,
adapted it.
Yeah, like, well, just described it. I mean, it was a tiny section, and everywhere else I was talking about social capital. The publisher said, oh, we're changing the name of the book to The Woofy Quotient, I think was the first one. I was like, what?
Woofy Quotient?
Wow. No. So at least I talked them into Woofy Factor, and I was like, okay, fine. I was a little nervous personally about using the word. Not because, you know, turned out that people generally are uncomfortable using it, especially the people that I really wanted reading the book, which were people that were, like, just getting into social media, not, like, people that were comfortable with it already, right?
Mm-hmm.
I wanted people that, but the word woofy just seemed too weird, or newbies, right?
Yep.
Yeah, so, you know, whether the word works or not, at the end of the day, that's, to me, like...
I think you still got the point across, though, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it doesn't matter. And the reason that my publisher changed the title of the paperback to The Power of Social Networking, which, you know, I hate that title equally, really, especially if you ask me. But, I mean, the content of the book is something... please don't judge a book by its title. The content is still there, and I'm still really proud of it and the examples that I bring up and that I really do think. And it's funny because I started speaking about the, you know, social capital stuff in I think it was like June or July of 2007. And then a whole bunch of other people, not that they copied me, but I think they have the same, you know how we have the same thought at the same time, like that sort of stuff happens?
A whole bunch
of other people.
The Me Too books, whether they mean to or not, they feel like a Me Too book.
Right, but they were probably original thoughts, but a lot of people started talking about the same thing shortly after I started talking about it, like including like Seth Godin and some real big luminaries, right?
Yeah.
That's fine. But what I think is interesting is when I heard these talks come out like after mine, and as I was like finishing up writing, I was thinking, you know, well, obviously I'm on the right track with the thought here, and whether or not Woofy resonates as a term is for me beside the point. I'm just really happy that this whole area has grown and matured to the point that we're starting to really understand how important human values and human connections and relationships are to making the world go around. It's not about money. It is about relationships. It is about valuing human beings.
Yeah, it was interesting because I remember there was this like really limited seating event, and I couldn't go at the last minute, and part of it was my husband has this real reluctance to be a part of anything that feels kind of elite or whatever, and you know how it is when you're with somebody and it's like you feel like you're dragging them, and then you go, well, wait a minute, do I really want to go, or am I going because I'm meant to go? Or so anyway, I ended up writing this blog post, and Phil Bronstein actually picked it up and said, is the new social, you know, where you actually meet in person, which was kind of not the point. My point was just, you know, that what I think is a sad kind of, you know, and it really relates to Woofy is, you know, feeling like because you have Woofy within your community, that means you have the ability to kind of define a space when it's really supposed to be about community at large. So working with, like, say, the SMB market, and you have all these people out there that are going, like, am I doing it right? Should I be doing this? That are so scared, and, you know, you want to, like, hold their hand and bring them to the table, and then they want to go to events, but they're not invited, or, you know, they feel awkward because no one's including them in the geekier parts of the conversation. No one's reading faces. And a lot of that's pretty common sometimes if it's a more technical group because they just maybe don't have the social skills or whatever. But basically that was the point was I was trying to make anyway, which was, you know, that we have to be really careful because the next group of, you know, influencers that isolate themselves could be not us, you know, so we have to be, you know, really, really careful. And I think that that completely, you know, maps to what you're doing, and you've maintained, I mean, so many people before this interview have said, oh my God, I have to tune in because Miss Rogue's going to be on, you know, and they're referring to you by your Twitter handle, which is so funny. And then you have another group of people who, like, I know different people have said, oh, I saw you were going to have Tara Hunt on, and it got rescheduled. You know, are you going to ask her about, because, you know, you've physically look amazing. I mean, you've obviously been on a huge fitness, you know, I don't want to say fad, but, I mean, obviously you're, like, changing your body. You've changed your hair color from blonde to brunette, which so few people can do well. And it was funny because Karen O'Brien, who is a mutual friend,
love.
I guess. Yes. And I work with her on projects, and she said, you know, she put it really well, and hopefully she won't mind me ripping off her statement, but she said, you know, Tara just has really high goals in life, and she just goes for it. And I love that. You know, I really, really love that, because I think you go for it in a way that takes people along for the ride. So all of this to say, you know, I think it's
interesting. You're making me feel really good, by the way.
Oh,
you just
good.
Talk
well,
every day.
I'm glad. But I love the way that you just feel, like, really able to share, because there's different journeys we're all going through. And I think it's a good reminder for other people in the space. What I wonder, though, is when you go on the speaking circuit, because you speak at some pretty influential spaces, and I'll let you talk to that. But how does that factor in? So, like the first example I can think of was when I saw you speak at the Social Media Club event. The one thing that you were able to kind of have some control over was your book cover. Your original book cover, you said, was a community-inspired book cover, because you had a few, I think, some, if I'm recalling the story correctly, incorrectly, please correct me, but, you know, you had different friends or different designs were submitted, and you had a friend, and they came up with that design, and you really liked it, and so you were able to use it. And I just wonder how that translates to now, as your life has gotten kind of more influential and sort of bigger in terms of the community that follows you. Kind of a large question.
It's a big question. I don't even think. You know, I know I have lots of, like, I have big numbers of people that follow me, and a lot of people I don't know follow me. It still doesn't, like, I don't know. Maybe I'm able to keep enough removed from it. I never feel like I have a following. You know, I guess I always, like, I always still just feel like I'm part of the community, and it's not like I'm some sort of fancy pants person that, you know, like, can wave my arm and command things to happen. Like, I just don't. I mean, that would be awesome. Like, I could be like, all of a sudden, bring me cake. You know?
Yeah.
But, you know,
that didn't end well for her anyway. So.
But yeah, boy. Maybe I should, like, try that at some point. But really, I just feel like generally I'm baffled most of the time. Like, I have no idea why I would have a certain amount of followers. I mean, I'm all over the map. And like I said, you're making me feel really good. But I personally, part of it has to do with my ADD. I just can't. stand in one place for very long. I'm the type of person, I guess, that I get bored easy, so I try new things. And I'm also, like, kind of an A-type personality. Well, maybe not B-type, but, like, the kind of personality that is, like, if I'm going to do something, I throw my whole heart and soul into it. Like, it's not just, like, I'm going to dabble here and there. So when I'm going to get in shape, I'm going to, like, I'm going to, like,
run a marathon and be a fitness model, you know, some sort of thing. Or it's not just like, oh, I'm just going to get in shape. That's, you know, it's a big goal for me. I have to set like a big goal, because if I don't set a big goal, then I get really bored really easily. I have to like make it tough enough for myself that, So then I go from like, I don't go just from blonde to like dark blonde, or, you know, I don't do it gradually. I'm like, I'm going blonde, dark, like almost black brown.
Yeah, I mean, it's
all the way to the other side. You know, there's no gradual for me, which is also my mother always fretted over when I was a child, because I would do the same thing, one extreme to another, she would say, right? You're always one extreme to another. So that's just still who I am. And I've got...
So now everybody's going to want to know your sun sign.
Oh, I can't.
Are you a Gemini?
No, but Gemini. You know what? I have a strong Gemini rising, which might have something to do with it.
Who knows?
Yeah.
So what's your sun sign?
What's my sun's sign? My child's sign?
No, your sun's sign.
Oh, my sun's sign. Okay, I can't remember. Do you know what? I had this chart written for me a couple of years ago, and the guy basically, I can't remember what my different signs were, but the guy's like, you're an opposite in everything. So whatever
there you go.
I am, I'm always opposite. So whatever house it is, I had the two opposing signs always in battle.
Right.
And like,
and
I haven't ever seen a reading like that where you're like so the whole one extreme to another thing, I guess, really.
So, you know, as one of the things, one of my many questions within the question was, and there's my ADD showing, you know, is sort of how it works when you, you know, as you go to these larger and larger conferences and you're keynoting rather than being a speaker, you know, how does that work for you? I mean, kind of what goes through your head and, you know, I mean, how much is it about social capital now? Are there different topics that you're talking about?
Yeah, so the first thing that goes to my head is, what the hell am I doing here again? I mean, like, how is what I'm talking about going to be relevant to the funeral and crematorium association exactly? And, like,
oh,
that
goodness.
Sort of thing. I know, but at the end of the day, like, I used to just, when I first started, I would just put together presentations based on what I thought would be important, and then I realized that was a hit or miss. So I just started talking to the organizers and being very like, okay, why did you hire me? Like, so I asked the question, what about what I've said has resonated with you before? Or did you just like, was I the cheaper version of in that space?
Oh,
like,
God.
What is it that made you want to have me at this conference? And what do you want? What's that one message that you want me to get across to your audience, right? Because there's a reason usually why they have me there. Like, they've read my book, or they've read an article, or they've, you know, or they've seen me speak somewhere else, and they're like, yeah, we really like this particular point. So I usually build a whole talk around a specific goal that the conference organizers have. But generally, it's generally in the area of how the social web is changing the world. And what I find, I mean, there's so many angles to talk about how that's happening, and especially when I really do like the verticals, like the industry vertical conferences that I go to, whether it's a Builders Association or a Funeral and Crematory Association, or just not long ago, I just spoke at a telecom conference, right?
Mm-hmm.
Every industry is being affected in a different way by this, and every industry is like, I have no idea, like, what to do with this change. No idea. And
really curious. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that's what I build a talk around, and make sure that I can answer their questions. And it's not like, oh, well, here at Twitter 101, set up an account and blah, and here's what you say and tweet 4 to 6 times a day. Like, that stuff's BS to me. It's how do you, like, talk to people in the – it's bringing everybody back to the origins of business, really.
Yeah. Actually, Karen and I worked on a project together where we had two kinds of ambassadors for the project that were out there engaging in conversation. And the one that you know, normally is more of the, you know, technical type was actually the one that had, like, honest, real conversations with people and constantly was getting, you know, stars and awards from the different communities she was in as a result, because she was being completely honest and just, you know, we either do or don't have a resource for you, and let me find out if we can get more. And, you know, I mean, it was really nice. And also, she was from a different part of the country. She was from Nebraska. So it was really nice to talk to her, because it was like outside. She knew all the same stuff, but it was, she approached it from this very different perspective. And I really, really loved that about her. And it was kind of interesting that what you were saying completely reminded me of that, of, you know, part of your appeal is that you just have this, you know, sort of way of looking at the world that's very accessible. And I'm wondering, like, you know, part of you is that you know, we kind of mentioned earlier, we were talking about sun signs, and you were asking about your son, but you have, you're a mom and you've successfully raised your son. And how much did that impact your journey in life?
Yeah,
it'd be huge.
Successfully raising a child is a matter of perspective, I think. So, I've always struggled with motherhood. Like, to be totally honest with you, like, I'm not, like, I was never the perfect mom. I was always, like, really uneasy with it. You know, I did my best to make him, all I could do well, I thought, was make him feel like awesome and that I love him. Like, that's all I could do well. Everything else I felt like a big fail with. Like, I wasn't so good at making food, you know, kids' food, and like birthday parties. I was kind of a disaster on. I certainly was not focused on his sports team stuff. I would fail at being the mom who brought the snacks that week. Trying to help him with his homework, you know, after a certain point, I was like, I don't remember this stuff. Polynomial. Like, talking to him about the things that I needed to talk to him about, you know, sex, girls, whatever, you know, it's like everything. I just felt like I'm not doing a very good job, and I was always, because I'm so career focused, I would miss cues, I would miss things, the only part that I felt like you could actually do anything right is like tell him that he's awesome and that I love him. And
this is where you have such appeal, because you're being so honest. It's like, I want to just reach through the phone and give you a hug and just say, you know, nobody's perfect. It's very, very okay. But in the end, like, I mean, it seems like that would probably influence your work to some extent too, right? Because, I mean, obviously being a mom adds incredible depth to you as a person.
Yeah, I'd like to say yeah, and I think probably it adds depth in a way that I think people don't really necessarily assume, right? So for me, I think if anything, being a mom, and especially a single mom, made me a survivor more than anything, right? Like, I found a way to juggle everything, and at the same time, like, grow a career and feed myself and my son and have a life, and like then as my life was kind of getting exciting, like figure out a way to balance that with being a mom. Like when I see, it's kind of frustrating because I'll see all these like articles and these big things where, oh, you know, another 22-year-old got $3.5 million in funding for his startup. You know, like, and I, you know, they're celebrated and they're put on the cover of Wired magazine and Fast Company. And, you know, I just, for me, it's like, it just seemed like their lives were so easy compared to having to balance that. I couldn't have when I was in my early 20s because my son was still a toddler, work those kind of hours. I couldn't have done that sort of thing. So it makes me even hungrier for it in a way. It also, at the end of the day, like, makes me take more calculated risks with things. I don't know. It's given me depth in other areas that I don't think people really necessarily assume about motherhood, like just coping skills, learning that you can't be bitter about things, right? So when I look at these articles and I'm like, I feel bitter. No, I can't be bitter because, you know what, at the end of the day, you have what you have and you got to do what you can with what you got, right?
Absolutely.
And by being bitter, that's just shooting myself in the foot. Instead, like, it's taught me to be all like, good for them. That 22-year-old that just got $3.5 million. Probably never know what to do with it. But that's all right, because then that just means, like, okay, well, what do I need to do at this point to be able to do the same for my startup? Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think you were going to give another really good example, or celebrate.
Yeah, we'll just celebrate like what I've already accomplished with what I have, you know, like.
Oh yeah.
And Jesus, I've accomplished a lot for. I've put a lot of challenges up in front of myself, which I've been able to actually make, you know, finish and actually do quite well with, just despite the barriers that I have. So stop whining and keep going. Like,
yeah, and I bet a lot of people are probably jealous of you. So that's, you know, the other end of the spectrum as well is like.
So I can feel really good about that.
Like, yeah. So I want to make sure, because we're running low on time, that we get to talk about your new startup. Now, one of the things, again, that I think makes you such an appealing character is you talked about going to TechCrunch Disrupt, where you chronicled, I don't know if it was on your blog or if I read it through Facebook or what, but you asked your development team to, like, basically compress their development cycle hugely to make it even happen. So talk to us about your startup, how I say the name properly, because I'm not going to, is it Show Up?
I hope, I'm going to get that recorded because I'm going to do this whole thing in the future. It's like all the great ways that people say the word. I love that somebody said schwomp the other day. It was like, awesome. It's schwomp. But wow, it's shop. I love it.
Oh,
no,
I
see.
Okay.
It's funny. It's the worst. It's worse than Woofy, let me tell you. As far as naming conventions go, I think I have a new winner on that one for sure. But,
thank you. All right, so talk to me about this awesome new startup that you, and the way that you, I mean, just the way that you're able to get your team to, like, bust their ass to get ready for something like TechCrunch, which is kind of scary in and of itself for different reasons, but.
God damn, it was scary. 2,000 people in that room. And, you know, I don't know that. Just being on that stage, and there were so many great startups, and a lot of them had funding or were way further along than we were. So just to be on that stage was a huge honor. And wow. But yeah, I, when I applied, I told the team, and they all looked at me like, I was nuts because I think that we were 6 weeks out from TechCrunch, and they were like, well, you know, we probably won't be accepted anyway. And I said, no, let's work like we are accepted already. And they all kind of, I think, grumbled a little bit and were like, you know, when I wasn't looking, they were like, what is she nuts? Like, what is she thinking? We have like 4 months of work here, and she wants us to compress it into 6 weeks? Seriously? What is she on? So, but I had this gut feeling that if we applied and we got in, and even if we didn't get in, it would give us like a really great incentive to work towards. I mean, no matter what, like this is even going back to my own personal goals, right? If I set them really high and really lofty and give myself like time deadlines on things, right? So whether it's I have to look amazing in a bikini in 3 months, or I have to run the Great Wall of China marathon in May. I still think that one's a little crazy, but that I put these huge like pressure filled, there's no way possible that we'll be able to do that goals out there. And constantly it's about surprising yourself and seeing that you can do it. Well, I put that on top of other people who didn't feel the same way about goal setting as I did. But, you know, they were awesome. It was perfect for the team because, you know, yes, there was tension. Yeah, there were moments of, like, there were tears. Even, you know. But at the end of the day, like, the fact that we get it, everybody sort of looked at each other in disbelief and then, like, cheered. And it brought our team really close together, and it was really fantastic and exactly what we needed. Because, you know, without these sort of, for me, like, the secret in the startup is creating impossible deadlines. And ones that are not, like, they're sort of do or die in a way. I've watched this over the years. I've worked with tons of startups, and you can get into one of the things that I find that the biggest downfall for certain startups is that they get into the must always get better. It's not perfect enough. It's not perfect enough. So we're not going to launch. We're not going to launch. It doesn't work well enough. It's like, we're not going to launch. They push the launch dates for a product until, you know, they lose all momentum, and the team feels absolutely like unexcited about what you're doing anymore, and the product doesn't even look like what you started out talking about. And in the meanwhile, no customer has even touched it. And
yeah.
So for me, and it's hard not to do that, because no matter what, you look at it and you're your own biggest critic. And for me, I just have to stop and think, no, it's got to get out there, even though I know it can be better. And we're actually hitting the go button, launch button. The day after tomorrow. We were going to do it tomorrow, but we decided the day after tomorrow. And I'm totally not happy with the product yet. I'm not. I want it to be better, but it has to get out there further. I mean, we launched a TechCrunch, and then a week later, I think it was, we sent to a small, like, 20 people group of 20 people to sort of give us feedback. We got that feedback and said, okay, 2 weeks from now, we're launching. I think we have a list of close to 2,500 people waiting. We're going to launch to 2,500 people. And everybody on the team once again looked at me and was like, you're crazy. It's not where it needs to be. But you have to do that in order to get people to, like, you're not going to grow unless you have the people that you want using it giving you feedback, right?
Absolutely. The feedback loop is so key. And on that note, we are definitely going to have a separate show on your startup and just sort of being a female entrepreneur, especially as you're in Canada, and there's all these interesting pieces to what you're doing that I think a lot of other people can sort of learn from. But thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show, Tara. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You are a rock star. Thanks so much. That was Tara Hunt, folks. I'll let you get on with your day, Tara, so feel free to get on with whatever you need to do. You're very welcome. And another A-lister is on the A-list, and I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in, however you did, to the A-list with me, Jennifer Lindsay. We hope you enjoy the program here on Blog Talk Radio or on iTunes. And, of course, we want to hear from you, so please start tweeting in or Facebooking in your questions or even emailing now for our next guest, which will be revealed soon. For archives and more information on the show, you can always head over to jenniferlindsay.com. Thanks so much and have a great week.